The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hello everyone, I'm writer, editor and book connoisseur Claire Williamson, here with another installation of A Little Bit Booked on Fresh FM this decidedly autumnal day. With me today is someone whose work you're probably familiar with, even if you didn't know it. Gavin Strawn is a former screenwriter and showrunner who has worked on everything from Shortland Street and Mercy Peak to Go Girls. He's trained as a nurse, joined the circus, and his first novel, The Call, won the 2023 Allen and Unwin Fiction Prize. Its highly anticipated sequel, Slash, came out earlier this month. Kia ora, Gavin. Welcome to the show.
Okay, how are you doing?
Good. You might have to explain to me the connection points between trained as a nurse and joined the circus.
Oh, I thought it was obvious. No? Oh, anyone that's worked in the healthcare system would probably agree. Long story, but when I was 19, working in a warehouse, saw an ad that they were encouraging men to become nurses because they wanted someone to do the heavy lifting. And those were the days when you used to train in hospitals and used to do in training. But it was the three-year registered nurse course. And unfortunately, it was at the Repatriation General Hospital, which was mostly old soldiers and their dependents.
Mm.
So anyway, I lasted about 2 years and then ran away. And through a series of other events, I ended up at university doing biology because science was... Well, biology was one of my loves. The first book that really influenced me was Gerald Durrell's My Family and Other Animals, and that's really what I wanted to be. So I did biology in English, but unfortunately I started going out with an actor. That was the ruin of my life, really. So I ended up doing an honours degree in drama. And then those were late 80s. That was the time of a lot of community theatre and a lot of physical theatre, and I was involved in setting up a community circus.
And what was your act?
Well, I had done gymnastics as a young person, and then when I got involved in theatre, we were doing a lot of very physical theatre, and so I would teach, you know, the basics, backflips and handstands and bit of trapeze and, you know, all that stuff. Anyway, I ended up at the Flying Fruit Fly Circus in Albury, Wodonga.
As you do, casually.
As you do. And in fact, and then anyway, long story. I told you there is no short version of that story, is there? So I ended up in Sydney, rode around to production houses, said, give us a job. I'm a writer from, you know, playwright from Adelaide. And I got a job as a trainee script editor on Neighbours, which led me to get a job helping to set up Shortland Street. But I also had a gig still booked for the circus after my first 6 months at Shortland Street. So I thought I was only coming to New Zealand for 6 months to help set up.
Right, and then you were going to go back to the circus.
Yeah, well, I had a grant to write a play based around what they were learning. Because in my alter ego life, I'd been a playwright. The actor I'd gone out with, we'd set up a theatre company, and we also played in a band together. So there was a whole mixture of, she was a singer and I was a guitarist. So there was a whole mixture of things.
I love how all of these seemingly unconnected skills come together for you.
Well, then I became Shortland Street's first medical advisor.
I shouldn't laugh. You were actually qualified.
I did 2 years of the training, so it was. But we had a lot of trouble getting nurse advisors or medical advisors in the early days because no one wanted to be tainted with Shortland Street. So I did have to do a lot of but I was in science. I was reading what was going on in medicine at the time, so that helped. Leonard Dodds's obsession with Manuka honey was because I'd read an article in The New Scientist, you know.
Well, fair enough. I'm a terrible import, and while I know of Shortland Street, I still haven't seen an episode.
Well, you know, that's
Is there one I should start with? Is there like a good standalone one?
I mean, it's one of those things, you know, you work on something. I am not a natural soap opera viewer, you know. I'm an elderly man. But even when I was a not so elderly man, I wasn't a natural soap. But once you get involved in something, you become obsessed with it.
Mm.
And you really get into it. But I didn't. I've never watched Shortland Street since I left. Why would I?
Well, fair enough. Have you been reading anything good recently?
Well, I just started The Covenant of Water, which seems I'm always way behind the eight ball, partly because I read books that people leave behind, and also, I don't know, it's just when things are all trendy and everyone's talking about it, it puts me off.
No, there is a,
But I really loved Cutting for Stone. I read it a long time ago before it got a lot of fanfare, and it was the book I gave to people for presents.
Mm.
And then when Covenant of Water came out, it was like, oh no, what if it's not as good? So there's been a long delay.
And so far, is it as good as you wanted it to be?
I'm only 30 pages in and it's very thick. I just read Han Kang's We Do Not Part, you know, the Korean, Korean, which is amazing. She wrote, I really love The Vegetarian, and this is equally weird and political. It's really good. I really like it. And I just finished Truth, which is Peter Temple, who wrote the Jack Irish series, just to keep it in the thriller.
Mm.
So he wrote the Jack Irish series, but Truth was his last novel, I think, and before he died, and it's quite amazing, really.
I appreciate the eclectic selection.
Well, yes, I am very eclectic in my reading. This is great.
Right. So before we dive into Slash,
yes,
I wanted to pick your brain a bit about going from writing for screen to writing for a novel. And one thing I did I did my research, read some previous interviews, and one thing you said that had frustrated you was the lack of good dialogue and characters. And so what for you is the hallmark of good dialogue?
Oh, where did I say that and in what context?
I think you were talking about the trying to find writers to first come on Shortland Street when it was starting out.
Well, yeah, the problem, I think, the very simple level of dialogue is either dialogue doesn't support the story. It sort of goes off on tangents, and sometimes they're delightful tangents, and sometimes there's no rule of thumb. But the other thing is that dialogue pretends to be real, but it's not, and it's serving the story, the characters. It's doing a whole lot. So it's very disciplined, even when it might feel quite loose. And so a lot of people either write dialogue that's totally on the nose, where the characters say exactly what they think.
Which, of course, no one does this. Well, very few people does this.
But not to confuse real life with fiction. In fiction, we pretend, you know, you're getting the story across while pretending not to. So in real life, people ramble on like I'm doing now forever, and they go off on tangents and they talk about the circus and, you know, there's all these things. And in the meantime, there's their character coming through, like, you know, does he ramble on? Is he losing the plot? That's coming through the dialogue, but I'm not saying I'm losing the plot or I'm rambling on, right, for example.
Mm.
But a lot of the early dialogue writers of the Shortland Street would write exactly. People would walk into a room and go, I'm really angry. And instead of walking into a room and saying to somebody, get your feet off the table, you know. So, dialogue serves a function. It illustrates what the character's feeling. But it's a fine line between carrying the story.
Mm.
You know, on a good level, dialogue will do, well, I don't know, two or three things. It'll carry the theme of the story, like underlying what's going on. It'll carry the plot, and it'll do something to enhance your understanding of the character. Mm. So it'll do them all at once while still looking natural, if that's what you're going for, natural dialogue.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot of books where you read them and you can tell something is off but it's hard to pin down. I listen to the call on audiobook, and I often find you can really tell in audiobooks if characters don't sound like real people and they sound kind of like robots just saying things because there has to be dialogue. And whoever the audiobook narrator was did a chef's kiss, A+ job with
Gareth
that.
Gareth Reeves is his name. He's a New Zealand, but a Melbourne-based, I think, New Zealand.
Anyway, he did a brilliant job, and I did note how natural the dialogue felt, particularly between your main character, Honey Chalmers, and Marshall, and also her mum.
Yeah. Cool. Mm. Thank you.
So there will be some spoilers, I think, for the call in this chat. I'm not going to restrict us that much, otherwise we will generally be rambling and talking in circles and not getting to say one single straight thing. Though Slash can more or less stand on its own. And so the premise, for people who haven't read it yet, is that you have left ex-police sergeant Honey Chalmers in a decidedly not great place.
She's not living her best life.
No, she is not. Following a fatal shootout a year prior, she's drinking, she's got PTSD, she's plonked herself in a dead-end kind of private investigator job thing, and one day a desperate father asks her to investigate his missing son, a double murder suspect last seen during the chaos of Cyclone Gabrielle, and this request brings her into the orbit of forestry shenanigans and weird teenagers and some pretty intense drug networks.
Yeah.
Just that.
Just the usual.
Yeah, day in the life.
Yeah. I mean, also, I guess the landscape itself has been devastated by something that happened previously in the same way as her internal landscape's been devastated by something that happened previously. So that was the drawing the two things together in terms of character.
So the parallel of the literal slash and debris and people being left to pick up these horrible pieces and not knowing where to start and her internal struggles.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, definitely down here in Nelson, we didn't have it to the same degree as Gisborne and Hawke's Bay, but definitely could a lot of the red sticker, yellow sticker resonated a lot because we had our own really bad floods in 2022. So I'll admit with the call, you had me because I thought for most of the book that Y22 was a real place. And I did eventually go into Google Maps and I typed in Y22 and something in Southland popped up and I was like, that doesn't feel right. It's definitely they're definitely in the North Island. So it is fiction. It is realistic but fictionalized. And then you didn't get me with Slash. I was like, great, Bergeton, that's got to be representative as well. What, for you as an import to New Zealand, do all small towns seem to have?
Well, it does depend. I think Waiutu and Bergeton are quite different.
Mm.
You know, Honey, I wanted Honey to see some similarities, and she does. But also the devastation and the town picking itself up is different. Mm. I also grew up in a country town in South Australia, and I have lived in country towns, and I had a place out on the Fitu Peninsula, which is, I don't know if V2, but there's a petrol station, general store, or nothing else. And my kids went to school at a V2 area school. So some of the characters and feel is just drawn from that experience. And some of it's drawn from just travelling around New Zealand. When I drove up the East Coast before Cyclone Gabrielle and after, it had such an impression. I mean, you know, you see the land. I love, and I think this is an outsider thing. It's interesting because Peter Temple, who wrote Truth, he writes quintessential Melbourne macho cop culture. But he didn't grow up in Melbourne. He grew up in South Africa, I think.
Mm.
And I call it the Eric Bogle syndrome. There was a songwriter called Eric Bogle who wrote the band played Waltzing Matilda, which is a beautiful song about Gallipoli. He'd been in Australia he's a Scotsman. He'd been in Australia for 2 years when he wrote that song. There's a thing about coming from outside sometimes, I think, that helps you see things. I mean, obviously there's brilliant local writers who can do brilliant country towns, but my version of them is what I see as an outsider, which is maybe different a little bit.
So then as you went to visit Gisborne and you saw the before and after, and so you could really put that on page, what else did you have in mind when you were building up the setting for this second book, bringing Honey back into...
Well, originally I wanted to bring her back later because facing grief and stuff, I was just worried it would be tedious. You know, other people's grief is not necessarily very interesting. And so and then I realized it was kind of me trying to avoid the emotional impact.
Do the work.
That's right. And so originally I wanted to send her to Thailand because she was looking for her father. I don't know, it might still come up. And I thought the obvious thing in Thailand was drugs, right? Mm. And those factories near the border and up north. And then when I started to research Thailand, I realized that an unspoken thing was the illegal timber trade in Thailand.
Today I learned.
Yeah. And that led me to go, well, we have timber here. I don't have to send her away the way to Thailand. And then I'd been watching, John Campbell did that series of short documentaries about the timber. And I thought one of the really interesting things there was that although it covered the locals and the devastation and asked the questions, nobody from the timber industry was interviewed. And I didn't know if it was because they weren't available or they were hiding. And when people from the timber industry are interviewed, they're representatives of the timber industry. They're not the people that own the companies. They're not the shareholders in Mumbai or Toronto or Malaysia or, you know. So that really interested me. And then the other thing that sort of came hand in hand with that was Cyclone Gabriel. I've got this terrible thing, which I think is just a writer's disease, where when something horrible happens, you just see opportunity. And you're watching something as horrible going on and you're going, wow, what a great place to hide a body. What a great, you know, way to lose somebody. Do you remember about immediately after Gabriel, the police were kind of ticking off their list of missing people and there were still a few stubborn few at the end of the list they couldn't find. And I thought, well, maybe they don't want to be found. And if you wanted to disappear, a natural disaster would be a good time to do it. So all those things came together, if you like. And I wrote a sort of first draft and then visited. We've got some friends that live in Waipukoro. Mm. They have a farm. And going there and then talking about their Gabriel experiences just really enriched the whole experience.
Did that opening sheep scene come from them?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God.
And, you know, other stuff, synchronicity. Like, I didn't plan on sending Honey to Fiji. It's not too much of a spoiler. She goes to Fiji. but a lot of the workers come from Fiji or from Pacific Islands, and they come over and they get seasonal working visas and get exploited. But also it's a two-way thing. I mean, my farmer friend said the property next to him had been sold. And the day after the deal was signed, 60 Fijians turned up and planted the whole farm in pine. And he's got nothing against Fijians. You know, he wasn't saying that. He was just saying it's like bringing in people en masse, getting them to do. And you go, pine forests, just they're so ugly. And you go, carbon capture. What happens when there's a big fire and all the carbon gets given back to the environment? Do they have to give back their carbon credits?
Oh, God, a blaze of glory, literally.
Anyway, all that. As I was saying about this coming here, I mean, I've been here more of my adult life, but when I first arrived here, I just did so much bushwalking and I just love the New Zealand bush. And I think, you know, coming from South Australia, which is just so dry, just the water, you know, and then discovering 70% of the rivers are too polluted to swim in. You go, oh my God, you people, what are you doing? Come from a dry state. Come from the driest state and the driest continent and tell me that you should treat water that way. But also the forest, but just the tree ferns and the nicotine palms. And the, oh my God, I just love it. Mm.
I think that's a good seg into one thing that struck me about both the call and slash, which is how much of the conflict is centered, happens because systems fail people. You know, there's the social systems that are kind of failing Chloe in the call, and that lead to the formation of these, you know, violent gangs and their networks. And there's kind of a failure of corporate accountability that leads to forests being planted as these mono pine graves, you know, this like dead forests. And there's, you know, there's a failure of the police and that kind of what that looks like. I just thought it was a really interesting backdrop and way to approach a thriller. And I'd love to unpick your thoughts about why and how you chose to pick these different criticisms, maybe?
Well, I think listening to people in forestry rabbit on about all that they've given to the community, and I think it's true on a community level amongst contractors. But this is what I meant by the forestry companies themselves. I mean, it's almost like they're at arm's length. And because they weren't available for interviews, or they're really hard to track down, and if you go online, you'll just find representatives talking. You won't find people. Well, that's sort of open season for me.
exploit the uncertainty.
As far as the police goes, I mean, I think the police are mostly treated with respect, and I do have a lot of respect for the police, believe it or not. But I think there's a lack of an accountability, and that's come up lots of time. I mean, what is it? 39 people have been shot by police killed by police since 1990, and none of them have been charged. I don't believe that it was 100%, you know. So I think, and all the stuff that's gone on recently, with demonstrating how people had been trying to cover their asses. I mean, people forget, like when I first arrived here, the whole Louise Nichols thing was going on. Two of the people involved in that were in prison for a similar crime, but their crimes couldn't be mentioned in the court case. And things like that go on where you just go, this is wrong, you know, and there isn't the accountability. And I think New Zealanders have an undeserved smugness about lack of corruption in this country, because I think they don't, because it's a bit like Trump's America, where if you don't test for COVID, then there isn't any COVID. If you don't test for corruption, there isn't any either. And I think when you get out into the districts, you can get the most fantastic police officers who are totally involved in the community, doing a great job. And you can also get cops that are the opposite. And there is sort of lack of accountability both ways. I mean, obviously in a thriller, you don't want a wonderfully functioning police force.
No, that doesn't really allow for the individual investigations required.
Yeah, but also, I mean, you look, if you read coroner's reports, which is, you know, everyone's hobby, isn't it?
Casual. Yeah, of course.
You go, it's 5 years since this happened. And nothing, you know, and then there's an open verdict. And you go, what? There's no closure. It happens quite a lot, you know, more often than people recognize. So fortunately, most criminals are stupid and, you know, or just, you know, most crimes are kind of stupid crimes. I might say that people are stupid, but the crimes are stupid. So, you know, someone gets drunk and knifes their friend, or they run over somebody, or, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to solve it. And that keeps, you know, so that keeps things ticking over. But when things get a bit more complicated, that's the sort of area that you write crime thrillers in. because complication is interesting and also harder to resolve.
Mm.
Did that answer your question?
It did answer the question. And I mean, I think you did in both books. You have Honey as our main narrator, but you have a really fleshed out kind of side cast of people. And even if on paper they would be the quote unquote, well, we're and are maybe even the quote unquote bad guys, you do a good job of making people see why they would have turned to, say, setting up a giant drug network to, you know, have a stable job, quote unquote, and support their families and build a community that cares about them.
Yeah, I think, but also there's lots of levels. I mean, drug use, responsible recreational drug use, I don't think should be criminalized, because I think it just means people can make money.
Mm.
But it doesn't mean I think crystal meth is a good thing in our lives. You know what I mean? And I've known lots of people of all walks of life who thought they were in control and weren't. And so that wasn't so hard, because they're not bad people. But and I guess that's one of the themes of Slash, really, is you know, ordinary people do stupid things and bad things. And sometimes you have to go, well, is that worth ruining their life about? I mean, the legal system says yes, if they're guilty of it, let's ruin their life. But sometimes things are more grey than that.
Mm. So when we've got Honey kind of initially unwillingly, but then gets really, really hooked on solving the various threads of this crime or this mystery, how are you mapping it out in your own head for her, you know, to make sure there's enough question marks, enough uncertainty, it's not too easy, the criminals haven't been too dumb?
Partly it's just I feel my way there.
Mm.
And then sometimes you have revelations and you go, oh, that's why that happened. Then you go back and put a few pegs in place because you didn't even realize that was happening. I'm not a planner in that way. I mean, it's partly I think it was a reaction to working in television where you had to plan everything. You had to come in and you'd work out your week and you had to sell it to the producer and blah, blah, blah. And then and a lot of shows I've worked on, like especially in Australia, like Bad Mothers or Hide and Seek, which were both kind of crime, light crime kind of. They, you know, the network wanted to know what the commercial breaks were before you'd written the story.
Right, you're like, I haven't gotten there yet.
What's the banger? I don't know. And so for me, part of the joy of writing novels is the freedom of just getting up in the morning and going, where did I leave my character? Oh, that's right. What happens next? That's what I meant by about like sending her to Fiji. It was partly, and then as happenstance, as luck would have it, my nephew has a restaurant in Nandi, small community, like a suburban restaurant. It's nothing flash. But he lives there with his partner and run this restaurant. And so I went home and stayed with them. He introduced me to a poet, name I probably shouldn't use, in Suva, who, you know, took me to where he buys his drugs. And basically a lot of the research came out of that, which really fleshed it out. It was great.
Lived experience. Is there, I mean, I know that part of the call initially came from a very interesting sounding conversation you had with some members in the police force. But hopefully you're not completely seeking out, you know, crimes to like ride along with and add to your writing.
With Slash, the only thing that was an absolute, years ago I read about two young guys who did do a kind of crime spree and ended up murdering an old couple. It was, this is not giving away anything because nothing like that happens in my book.
Not at all.
And the kind of bad thing was the cops knew about them and kind of nobody, I don't know, they just, there was just a mix up with communications and, you know, they didn't get around to picking them up. And It was one of those kind of stories. And that was in the back of my mind. And then I wanted to subvert that, because that was kind of the expectation. So I played with that. But that's the only real incident that prompted it. The rest was sort of following the trail, really. And it led to all these characters that in The Call, I didn't know Marshall existed when I started The Call.
He was my favourite character.
Oh, that's great.
I was devastated.
Well, what happened was that I can remember it really clearly. Honey was going out to the golf club with her mother for dinner, and I didn't want things to go smoothly. So I thought, well, what's an obstacle? Or she meets an old boyfriend. And then I thought, oh, that's such a cliche. What about if he's not a boyfriend? What about if he's like her oldest, dearest friend? And then I had to work out why they hadn't seen each other in so long. And, you know, I had to create this. So Marshall grew out of character function.
Oh, no, he was so good. And, you know, you kind of did expect, I was like, again, slight spoiler for The Call, but we're talking about the second book, so it's fine. I did kind of was like, someone is going to die. And I had my bets on it was going to be Chloe, and then Honey was going to be equally devastated for a slightly different reason than Marshall.
I was so sad.
I say laughing. One thing that came up, and again, maybe this came up kind of unintentionally as you were writing Honey as a character, but one thing that her BFF and potential future business partner, Michelle, touches on is that when Honey locks in, it's kind of to the detriment of all, she hyper-focuses, to the detriment of all relationships around her, you know, loses kind of social function for problem solving. And so there was this quite a heavy implication that Honey was, you know, was neurodivergent in some way. And I don't know, was that intentional or did that not on your mind, came up unintentionally?
I think it's really hard. I mean, my son's very ASD and ADHD. And I did a bit of research, and neurologically, because of what she's been through, I kind of, part of her lack of focus is PTSD consequence of. But in terms of her doggedness, that's always just been a part of, you know, when she locked. But she's never been great with people skills, and, you know, I don't know where that comes from.
Well, she's good enough that, you know, they do a lot of pretty insane things for her.
Yeah. And she's good at, well, manipulation is a bad word, but she's good at manipulating in a good way. Towards a good end.
Supporting and encouraging.
That's right. But, her friend's view of her is different than her view of herself. So it's one of those things where you have an in and outer with a character. So you've got your character's point of view and they think they're one thing, and then their friend comes along and says, but you're this, and they go, no, I'm not. Oh, hang on. So I didn't want it to be too simple. I didn't want to label her too simply as, you know, there was a real spate of kind of neurodivergent cop characters that annoyed me a little bit. and I didn't want to label her in that way, but, you know, I was had to explore what the consequences of the PTSD and what she was a person, and the fact that she does lock on to the detriment of other people, and, well, you know, her heart's in the right place.
Yeah, she's a good egg. Where was I going to go from there? You've left the door open for her to come back again. Have you been mulling over what social issue might be underpinning her next?
Well, yeah, it's a little bit what we were talking about corruption in New Zealand. I'm interested in that as a topic. I've got a friend involved in local council politics, and I went down that road for a while.
But I'm stuck in the weeds with that quite a bit.
Yeah, but I'm not, you know. The councils in New Zealand are really interesting because they're responsible for Some of them are responsible for large sums of money, and the shenanigans that go on with mayors, you know, stopping being mayors and becoming property developers the next day is pretty. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on, but I'm not sure if that's the one I want to do. I might want to go bigger. I'm resisting going to a country town again. I'm sort of more interested maybe in doing something Auckland, Wellington based. So I've been exploring some ideas in that. McSkimming stole the thunder, didn't he? You couldn't like that.
People would say, yeah, that's too implausible. They wouldn't believe you.
That's right. My theory was someone planted the stuff to get to him, but, you know, because why would you leave that stuff to incriminate yourself? But anyway, I that's all totally conjecture, and I'm not slurring anyone. But I am interested in the bigger picture. I interviewed a senior police officer once for a project I was working on, and it was in Wellington, and it was in one of those strange buildings in Wellington, and he had two minders, one on either side of him, making sure he didn't say anything wrong to me while I was trying to interview him about something that had happened like 20 years earlier.
People can't see my face, but I'm making like this, like, face. Forgetting that podcasts are an audio medium.
Except a lot of podcasts are now. I'm sort of interested in that area. But I'm interested in where Honey goes next as a character. I mean, again, exploring her as a character and where she would be a year after the end of Slash is kind of an interesting exercise in itself for me as a in character building.
Well, that's true because, I mean, she'd made lots of strides in terms of working through her PTSD and own sense of guilt and self, but I don't think she was out of it by the end.
No, and post on her shoulder. But But also, you know, you would ask yourself the question, I think, would she let herself be happy? Be the next big question.
Yeah, she is the kind of person who might potentially accidentally, intentionally self-sabotage something. Yeah.
Snatch misery from the jaws of happiness.
Somehow. And otherwise, it sounds like you've got a stint at got an upcoming character event, talk, joint thing you're doing?
No.
No? No. Oh, that's my brain fart. I thought you had something in June.
Oh, I do some library talks and stuff like that. Sorry, that was my fault. Sorry. I'm doing a talk with Megan Nicole Reed, who wrote Other People's Bodies, which I've just read and I really enjoyed.
Okay.
I should have added
it. I'll add it to the list. I said I'll add it to your list.
Yeah. It was good. And we're doing a talk out at the East Bay's Library in Glenfield, which is really funny because Glenfield was where the Shortland Street studios were when we started.
So it'll be like very nostalgic. You can go back and take pictures in front of various walls and things where random like revelations happened.
They're no longer there, I don't think. It was funny because, you know, it was called Shortland Street because originally it was going to be shot at the TVNZ studios in Shortland Street, and Shortland Street was just its working name.
Oh, really?
And then nobody could come up with another name because once you start using a name all the time, it was like...
Well, it starts sticking is the thing.
That's
right. Oh, funny. And I knew there was a Shortland Street in Auckland, and I just kind of always assumed like, oh, that's where the thing is set. Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay.
How are we doing?
We're good. On that note, I think I'll wrap us up. And our little bookmark to close our episode this week is mostly a reminder for our Nelson listeners, which is that the Founders Annual Book Fair is coming up from 30 May through 7 June. It's one of New Zealand's largest book fairs. There's literally 400,000 plus books that people can come browse, purchase, and hoard. And people will probably see me there with a little Vox Pop mic harassing you to talk to me about the books that you've bought. So come find me. You should come down. It is a great time. There's like a running of the books where people stampede in on the first day. It's all very intense.
My wife is a visual artist, and she's exhibited in the textile arts quite a few times. Not this year for the first time in about, but the last 3 years, I think she's had something in there.
Oh, that's very cool. I'll keep an eye out for that the next time they have one. So yes, that is coming up. There's a Facebook event for people who want to keep on top of what happens in that. So thank you for coming on today to talk to me about Honey and the Call and Slash and politics and crime and character.
Thank you for having me, Claire.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. You can find me with Life Books, etc. at Accidental Tokyoite. And I tried to find you on social media to share, but I don't think you have one.
I have no social media. I was an earlier adopter.
Mm.
It didn't make me happy.
Fair enough.
And I had a tendency to say things I shouldn't. And so a bit of self-policing went on. I went, nope, I can't do this. It's just, it's a terrible thing. It's like I care too much what people say and I don't care what they think. And the two things just, you know, and then you have all these false lives and people, either their lives are fantastic or they're bleeding all over social media. You know, so I'm either embarrassed for them or envious. And so in the end, I just had to stop. So I did about like 10 years ago.
Oh, more. Good on you. No, you still have a Twitter, but you haven't done anything with it.
No, well, it's that problem. You can't get out of it until you go on it.
That's true. Then you get...
Yeah.
Yes. So people will just have to buy a copy of Slash and the Call wherever fine books are sold instead. and get to know you that way.
That's right.
So thanks everyone for listening and joining me in being a little bit booked.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you, or your group, would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.